Welcome. You are listening to a recording provided by Voice Republic at httpvoicerepublic.com.
You're listening to Back to Us Radio on the Back to Us Network.
Today's sponsor is Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio entertainment and information. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audiblepodcast.com/backtous. That is audiblepodcast.com/BACK2US.
Oh my gosh, you are not going to believe what they are talking about on the Strong Stance.
Good evening, Strong Stance listeners. Thank you once again for joining us on this monthly little jaunt we have through a wonderful hour-long conversation with usually some very great hosts and guests. We've got a really interesting topic for you today. We're gonna talk about some of life's transitions. As trans and genderqueer people, we often become so focused on our social, mental, and physical transitions that they start to grow to be larger than life, so much so that we forget that a transition is really just another word for a shift. It could be a shift in thinking, a shift in geography, a shift in expectations, a shift in marital status or family size. They all affect us as human beings, and they are yet another layer to our complex lives as trans, genderqueer, and queer people. And when we forget that fact, it makes it all that much easier for people outside of our community to see us as just the sum of our surgeries and not all of the other transitions and all of the other parts of our lives. So tonight we are going to talk about some other transitions in life that aren't just about gender reassignment surgeries or hormones or even the social transitions that we go through and legal transitions that we go through. We're going to talk about some of the other important life transitions and move beyond gender reassignment. And to do that, we have a wonderful guest who is a good friend, and he is going to talk about some of his last couple of years as well as the rest of his life. And so I want to introduce Nicholas Duran. Nicholas is 27 years old and was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis in early 2013. A gay trans man living in Virginia, he is now the facilitator of DCATS and is an advocate for both LGBTQ+ and disability rights. And I just want to thank you, Nicholas, for being here. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing well, thank you. And yourself?
I'm doing good. I'm doing really good. Nicholas, you and I have talked, obviously, several times, both in person and via email and things like that. And one of the reasons that I really wanted to have you on tonight's show about life's transitions is that I feel like in a lot of the subjects that we've talked about your life, whether it be your family or your medical status or anything like that, you've gone through quite a few life transitions in the last year or two. And, I'd like to talk about as many of those as you're comfortable with, but in particular, I'd love to talk about, your diagnosis with MS and how that's kind of affected your life. And I think that kind of to start that conversation, it's important for us to remember that there are different transitions that we have in life, right? Like there's the transitions that you have some form of control over, like a medical transition from one sex to another, or a move across country, or some other personal transition. And there's the ones that you don't, like being diagnosed with a chronic illness or a house fire or a death in the family. And the primary difference in my eyes between these two is preparedness. You know, you can prep for and save for and generally control certain variables in the former, like those transitions that you have some form of control over, but not so much in the latter. And so I'd love to talk to you tonight about a whole host of things, obviously, but if you could start by, giving folks a background. A lot of people hear MS or multiple sclerosis. Maybe they even know people that have been diagnosed. But could you give our listeners a little bit of background on MS and kind of what form it can take and what it is and what it means for you and that kind of thing?
Sure, because when I was diagnosed, I had no idea what multiple sclerosis was. I did not know what any possible outlook was going to be for me. Like, I had no idea. It was just something that I had never personally encountered. So I'm always glad to help educate people that might not know, just as I hadn't. MS is an autoimmune issue where your immune system attacks your central nervous system, particularly the brain, spinal cord, and optic nerves. And it's not sure why. They still don't actually know what the direct cause of MS is, but it attacks the protective sheath around the nerves in your central nervous system called myelin. And as it attacks that, it forms scar tissue. And that brings the name multiple sclerosis, which means many scars. And whenever areas of the myelin sheath or the nerves themselves are damaged, the impulses that travel from the brain are distorted, and that's what causes a wide variety of symptoms and why everyone who actually has MS has it completely differently. There's, a sort of set standard, I suppose, for what MS is. But everyone
Right.
gets affected in different ways because it just depends on where you form lesions in your brain. Like, if it forms on a certain area on the right side of the brain, it might make you walk funny, whereas someone else might just have a heat sensitivity because they formed a lesion in the complete opposite side of the brain, wherever those areas are and whatever it all means. And so it can be pretty confusing and very interesting, really. The way it just is totally different per person that has it.
So with it being different per person, obviously with the symptoms that are kind of expressed and manifest, is it also different in the speed with which, the effects of this illness can kind of make themselves known or even become, escalated? Like, does each person kind of progress at a different pace? Is it generally something that physicians can kind of point to and say, no, generally speaking, it's kind of this time frame from here to here and from here to here and that kind of thing.
Yes, that is also something that's different, though it does come down to four particular courses: relapsing, remitting, secondary progressive, primary progressive, and progressive relapsing. And personally, I have relapsing remitting, which is the most common course of the disease,
Okay.
which is characterized by very clearly defined attacks or like flare-ups and relapses, things like that. And then followed by recovery period or remission, where the symptoms improve at least a little bit, if not completely, as the disease progresses more slowly, whereas the other courses will either have no remission between relapses, and it's just constant progression, just really vicious attack of it, or not.
Wow. Yeah. And so you were diagnosed in early 2013. And so what actually made you go to the doc? Like, what was going on in your life to where you said, I really need to go and kind of talk to somebody about whatever's going on? And I mean, was there a battery of tests? Did you have some pain and discomfort or joint immobility? Like, what kind of prompted you to kind of seek medical attention?
I actually had a lot of pain and in particular joint immobility for about 3 years before my diagnosis, where I was actually misdiagnosed with fibromyalgia instead. But there was a point when my balance was getting just really bad. Like, I would just stumble around and just could not walk straight, no matter how hard I tried. My memory was very noticeably deteriorating at a very frightening pace. Issues with like my vision, and my hands were shaking, like I had tremors. Like, in the beginning, I was worried it might have been early onset Parkinson's, and many of the symptoms are actually similar. And so it was when I was stumbling around as if I were drunk and couldn't think straight, couldn't remember anything, and had difficulty holding things with the way my hands were shaking that I realized that it was not fibromyalgia. It was not just a pain disorder. It was something neurological. And so I sought out a neurologist. And when I did, after, you know, a couple of appointments and getting to understand things, I had an MRI. And it was in that MRI that it was revealed that I actually had multiple active lesions in my brain, like 8 or 9. And when my neurologist at the time saw the results of this MRI, he immediately suggested that I get admitted to the Virginia Hospital Center for, you know, further testing and confirmation. And that is where I spent the next week getting, had another brain MRI, full body MRI, CAT scans everywhere, had about 20 vials of blood drawn, and a spinal tap, which was the final confirmation. Because I had lesions not only in my brain, but also down my spine. And then the spinal tap is one of the kind of deciding factors for the most part. And that was when, like, after an entire week there, they gave me the official diagnosis of multiple sclerosis.
So in your opinion, between the time that you started really noticing the pain and the, you know, some of the oddities with your mobility and things like that, to the time that you were diagnosed, did it feel like it was a very quick onset? Like, did it feel like, you know, one week I was fine and the next week it was kind of, I was completely off balance and I had all this pain? Or did you feel like it was kind of a slower progression that you just noticed was getting harder and harder?
It was more something that was slower at first, because I think around when I was 24, if like 23 or 24, I started having like pain in my lower back in particular. And I wasn't quite as mobile and, you know, agile, I suppose, as someone that age should have been or would be expected to be.
Right.
And so I just had, like, these little things kind of built up, and that's when I ended up getting diagnosed with fibromyalgia. Because at first it just seemed like pain. It just
right.
seemed like a pain issue. And then it was pretty much over the course of one whole year that everything else just went absolutely crazy and just got worse and worse, where I was like, this isn't okay. This is something else. There is something very wrong here.
So were your doctors actually trying to treat you for fibromyalgia?
Yes.
Because they had diagnosed you with that?
Yep. I had been seeing a rheumatologist who diagnosed me with fibro, and when I got my diagnosis for MS, I was on 12 prescription medications.
Wow.
10 of which were directly meant to be for the fibro issues. And as soon as I got the diagnosis, I stopped all of them cold turkey, which that's not a suggestion to anyone. That is not something you're supposed to do. Ever.
We do not go out medical advice on the strong stance.
Yeah. So don't normally do that. Consult your doctor before stopping a medication. But I stopped all of them at once. My doctor said it was okay. And
that's good.
Everything, like, it was like night and day almost how different I felt. Like, back in 2012, I was using a wheelchair, and now I use just a cane. And I, you know, I also lost like 50 pounds within 2 months after stopping those medications, because that was just a side effect. It wasn't anything that I had been doing. And
so was it the medication for the fibromyalgia that was it, you know, you said that you were in a wheelchair. Was that because you weren't treating or weren't doing anything about the MS? You were instead doing something about the fibromyalgia? Or was it because the medications for the fibromyalgia were negatively affecting your body because it was the wrong diagnosis and kind of putting you in that wheelchair?
That was it. It was because they were trying to treat the wrong thing. As soon as I, you know, got the correct diagnosis, I began a medication called Tysabri, which is debatably one of the most efficacious disease-modifying drugs that there are for MS right now. And it is a monthly IV infusion. And ever since I've been on that, so many of my symptoms have finally improved. And I've seen, you know, while there is, because MS is a progressive disease, there will be bad progression. I have progressed so much positively since starting something that was actually meant for what I have.
That's great. That's really great. So, I mean, that sounds like a lot. You know, you're talking about, you know, 3 or 4 years here where whether you've been diagnosed with one thing and treating that and then getting a more accurate diagnosis and correctly treating that. I mean, how has this diagnosis, both with whether when they thought it was fibromyalgia and now when they correctly have you diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, how has that changed your life?
With a diagnosis, your entire life can change. All of your priorities, your hopes, and your dreams are either put on hold or they're forced to change. While worrying less about things that were once considered a big deal, you also become more grateful for the smaller things because you only get one life to smell the roses. And so you learn to make the most of everything that you have, from your current situation to every little experience. And since you never know when you may not have another chance. Because while right now my main symptoms are things like cognitive impairments, bad balance, fatigue, who knows that maybe next year I might end up paralyzed. And so I have done a lot to change how I live my life to try and get the most of it.
So I guess, you know, like you said, that kind of changed the way that you kind of viewed life because, I mean, you realize you only have one. It could be tomorrow or next year or whatever that things change. How do you deal, does that change the way now that you deal with fear, whether it be with this diagnosis or with other things in your life? Did it change things that aren't necessarily affected by it, but there you kind of look at them in a different way, like, how do you deal with fear? How do you deal with, you know, that ability to put yourself out there or not? Is that changed? Is that different from the way it used to be?
Yes, very much so, because I had also been diagnosed with social anxiety, rather severe social anxiety. I have actually been seeing the same therapist through my entire transition specifically for anxiety and depression. And so I didn't go out much. I didn't experience much. And even though I still, you know, feel a little panicked, a little freaked out by a lot of social situations, I don't want to let it hold me back. And so I fight the fear and the hesitation so that I can have experiences that I may not have had before and that I may never have again.
Right. Wow. So do you think that this transition, you know, I mean, I think that obviously it's been you've had a very complex half a decade here. Do you think that having this diagnosis in any way changed your gender transition when it came to your gender reassignment, or like did it change your abilities to go through what most trans people would call the normal A to B, you know, I do this and then I do that and then I do this? Are there things that you can't do as easily? Are there medications that you can't be on? Are there surgeries that you have to be more careful of because of your diagnosis? Like how did this transition affect your other transition?
Oh, while I had, like, I was still in a state where I was not entirely comfortable with who I was and how I looked and how strangers might perceive me, like which gender they might see me as at first glance. And I wanted to still stay in my room until I was ready to come out.
Right.
Like, I just started doing it anyway. And as I did, I just felt more comfortable and a little more confident. But there were little things along the way. Like, it was shortly after my diagnosis that I became truly desperate for my top surgery. Like, I was, particularly when I lost all that weight, my chest was more prominent. And
right.
No matter how hard I was binding it, it was still obvious, where it hadn't been so much before. And so I had to have my top surgery. There was no question about it. But my neurologist at the time denied clearance for it. And I may have gone behind his back to get a second opinion.
You have to do what you feel like is right for yourself. I mean, I think that there's nothing, in my personal opinion, I don't think there's anything wrong with getting a second opinion from another doctor. You know what I mean? And so I can totally understand wanting to do that. Did you ever tell your neurologist, by the way, that you went and got a second opinion and got clearance, or did you just never go back?
No, and like I kept going even after the surgery. Like, I saw that neurologist a few more times. It was just like, not gonna say anything. It's all good. He doesn't need to know this. Like, I'm sitting there with the drains still in, hiding them under my shirt while getting an IV infusion in his office.
Like, oh, wow.
It was terrible, really. But, you know, I had to do it. And if this, you know, disease was going to hold me back just because they had just diagnosed it, when I know that, you know, really I had it for some time.
Right, right.
I was like, well, I don't know. So I just kind of went around and got whatever I had to do to get clearance from someone else. And so that was difficult, but it worked out.
As long as it works out, right?
Yeah,
that's not true. I'm not a huge proponent of the end justifies the means, but
yeah.
In some cases. So do you, you know, and this is just my own curiosity, other than that clearance that you were denied by your neurologist, did you have any other issues with your neurologist because you were trans? Like, you don't think that, like, did your neurologist have any kind of judgments about your gender identity or any kind of personal reservations about your transgender status? Or was it purely, I just don't think this is good for you with this diagnosis?
Part of the reason that I didn't hesitate, I suppose, in finding separate channels to get the clearance was because I wasn't sure. When I first started seeing him, I didn't say that I was anything but male. Like, on all of the forms that I first filled out, I just put male. Like, I just left it at that. And it wasn't until, like, maybe the third appointment that he, you know, started really asking about what other medications I was on so that he could prescribe me new ones and needed to know if anything would interact, that I admitted to being on testosterone and why. And up until that point, he never used anything but male pronouns, like, just saw me as male, didn't question anything. And then as soon as he knew, suddenly he was slipping up. You know, suddenly refer to me with female pronouns. And the nurse didn't quite know. And I guess he talked to her about it because one day she told me, like, her and the receptionist were, like, just suddenly decided to ask me very personal questions, such as that dreaded, have you had bottom surgery, do you intend to, et cetera, kind of stuff. And she told me that the neurologist thought it was weird and that he didn't understand it. And so,
That's uncomfortable.
Yeah, extremely. Like, the receptionist.
Let's start with inappropriate questions and finish with, your doctor thinks you're weird.
Yeah, right? Like, the receptionist was even like, I had no idea. Like, I would never have guessed. I would never have thought that. I'm really surprised. Right. And, like, you know, apparently my neurologist just, as soon as he learned differently, that just flipped something in his thoughts about me. And so after, you know, he had started using slipping up with female pronouns, I, you know, started to wonder if when I asked about getting surgery clearance and just said that it would, you know, be a something sort of like plastic surgery on my chest.
Right.
Nothing major. It's totally major. But I just wasn't sure if there was just genuine, this isn't good for you because of your disease, or it might not be good for you, but mostly I think it's weird. So.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean that's yeah. I mean, I think that's always important to be an advocate for your own health and your own well-being, your own mental and physical well-being. And I think that it's always very important to pay attention to what your doctors say and things like that. But if you ever feel uncomfortable or if you ever feel like, just don't know, I mean, that's one of the things that I always recommend, a second opinion. And I think that it's awesome that you just kind of went, okay, look, I'm not going to be the person that goes, oh, you're just discriminating against me. I'm not sure what it is. And so I'm just going to go talk to somebody else. Okay, pumpkin? So,
yeah.
I mean, yeah. So you said that you went back a couple more times. Have you since found another neurologist?
Yeah, I have actually had two different neurologists since. Like, I had one in between and now my current one.
That's cool. I mean, do you like your current neurologist?
In case he ever hears this for some reason, yes.
Sure.
Of course I do.
I mean, I wouldn't know, but I would imagine that it's got to be kind of a little difficult to really, quote unquote, enjoy someone that is regularly sticking you with needles or, you know, is treating you for something that doesn't make you feel good all the time. I mean, he's not the ice cream man. There's a reason why people don't like to go to the doctor. There's a reason why people don't like to go to the dentist. But I swear that ice cream man comes running down the truck, and, you know, the street, and you've never seen people move so fast. Grown adults moving so fast.
Yeah,
so
but,
I can understand that.
My current neurologist is at Kaiser Permanente, and so
okay.
far I am less than thrilled with just about every experience I've had with Kaiser Permanente.
That is a fair statement that I've heard in a good chunk of the community. So if anyone
yeah.
from Kaiser hears this, take note.
Yeah,
so,
like part of, and this kind of continues in with this, something I have been, like, my next step is my hysterectomy. And
okay.
that is something that, I guess, with Kaiser, you have to get all sorts of clearance and all sorts of whatever else. Like, you have to go through this whole process and path, and I have to have clearance, I guess, from two separate therapists that say I'm okay to, like, I know what I'm doing and I'm okay for it, whatever.
Wow.
And so I set up an appointment with one of the therapists at Kaiser because I was told this is what I had to do. And I go in and she, you know, of course, tries to just find out if I'm depressed, whatever, and just kind of keeps pushing as if she's trying to force me to sound more depressed than I was at the time. And
are
I'm just,
you
I'm
sure you're
just
not
like,
feeling down?
Yeah, and I was finally just like, no, I am specifically here to get this clearance for surgery, and that is it. That's really the only reason I'm here. And so then she asked, and I said that I was there for hysterectomy. And really, I suppose I should be flattered or feel validated in some way. She kind of just stares blankly for a minute and goes, you're a man. And then she asked if I was trying to get clearance for somebody else, which I don't even think you can do. But, yeah.
You
can't. Like, I was just like, no, you see, I mean for myself because I'm transgender. And that I need to get rid of it because I'm a man. And she just had no clue what I was talking
oh.
about Like, she had absolutely no understanding of what it meant to be transgender. Like, I had to kind of give and explain, like, I'm five, elementary school lesson in being transgender and going through transition in, like, a half hour.
Lovely.
To a doctor who had no idea what it meant. And no idea how I could be in front of her and clearly look and sound male and have male on my paperwork, but have a uterus. Like, she was so clueless and out of touch.
Yeah, and I think that there's a little bit too much of that still going around with a lot of doctors, but it does happen, and I think that the good sign is that we're not, you know, of course there's a part of us that aren't surprised by that, but it's less and less frequent, particularly in this area, and so when it does happen, we are unsurprised. I feel like that's a good sign, because we run into enough professionals now that kind of, they do understand it, and they do get it, and so... But, yeah, there's still a lot of education to be had. So tell me something. Before all of these diagnoses, were you ever – because I know this personally, because I know you, that you don't drive. Is that correct?
Right.
Okay. Did you ever drive, like, before these diagnoses? Were you just, like, a regular driver? Or are you, like, some of my friends that are, like, never had a license, never want one? Thanks.
I tried. Like I learned how to drive, and then I tried to get a license, and it just didn't work out.
Okay, so it's not like
I kind of
that was something massive that you had to give up.
Right. I kind of may have gotten into an accident on the way to get my license, and...
That's talent.
That's when I gave up right there.
You were like, it's a sign. Not doing it.
Yeah. So no, that's not something that I had to completely give up and get used to not having access to.
Well, other than driving, do you find that having this diagnosis makes you more or less dependent on other people?
I think that I am a bit more dependent, though I try everything that I can to...
Right.
Get as independent as I can. Like, I depend on my best friend Meredith, like, to get me to all of these very frequent appointments
right.
that I have and things like that. But I have been working to do more for myself, like, around the apartment than I did before,
right.
even though it's difficult. I still work at it, and I have learned to do many more things now than I was able to do before, even as I get worse.
Is that just by sheer force of will? Like, you just don't want to be completely dependent, so you're like, I'm going to learn to do all these things I never cared to learn to do before, just so that you can stay as independent as possible, or is that just, it just kind of happened that way?
To try and gain what independence is I'm able to.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to be... Like, I feel bad about and worry about just being a complete burden to others.
So, I mean, do you think that for you, I mean, obviously it's different for everybody, but is that your most, like, what's the most frustrating part of this? Is it that? Is it the fear of being a burden? Is it having to rely so much on other people? Is it just the pain itself? Like, what part of this whole diagnosis and this whole experience is the most frustrating? Because honestly, I'm seriously, you know, interested, because you are one of the most calm, level-headed, kind, you know, positive people that I've probably ever met. And so I can't imagine you dealing with, I've never seen you deal with anything around this with anything but a smile on your face, or at least a laugh at something that happened that would mostly make some people hit the roof with anger or frustration or whatever the case may be. So pull the curtain back for a little bit. What's the most frustrating thing that you don't like to let people see about this? Is it, you know, is it that reliance? Is it the pain? What is it that kind of you have to keep a lid on?
This is a particularly specific thing, I suppose, but one of the things that I'm very open about is one of my biggest problems since my MS is my cognitive impairments, and that is like my memory issues and having difficulty thinking critically and quickly, and things like I have trouble thinking of just the right word, which everyone has that, you know, once in a while. But it happens a lot more frequently with me, and there have been times that I have just completely forgotten a definition of a very common word and couldn't even understand the concept of something that I that should be very obvious or common or make sense to me. And that is extremely frustrating, particularly because I was a creative writing major when I went to university. I considered myself once upon a time to be rather eloquent and verbose even. And I had a very high, like my entire life, I had a higher vocabulary than like the grade that I had been in was expected to have. And I was, had no difficulty expressing myself and expressing my thoughts and my feelings. And now I have a lot of difficulty with that. And writing is very difficult now. Like, I just can't seem to get the same level of description of things because I just can't remember words the way I used to. I just feel like, it feels like there was a dictionary in my brain and most of the pages have been set on fire and have just burned up completely and gone away. And so that is probably been the most frustrating thing for everything that has been a challenge. Like, it's just one like seemingly specific sounding thing that is just the hardest. Whenever I'm in the middle of a conversation and like I have something that I need to get out or express, and I can't think of any way to word it because I just can't remember what words to even use. That's the hardest. Because I've always been very well read and enjoyed writing, and words were always my comfort. Like, I found a lot of comfort in words and everything about them. And now it like kind of like childishly feels like they've betrayed me. And
yeah, I mean, it's, I can't imagine kind of coming from, particularly if you were a creative writing major, coming from a very literary life and feeling like that's slipping away. And you almost would wonder, would someone who was not as verbose, as you said, or wasn't as into writing or as basically obsessed, might be a strong word, but so consumed with words, would they notice it as much? Would it be as upsetting to them to lose it? And so it's almost a very cruel irony of an effect that's kind of happened with your disease, that the one thing or one of the things that you really felt so much comfort and vibrancy out of is, as you said, being kind of set on fire and taken away from you.
But, yeah, it's been the hardest because I'm always in pain, like at every waking moment, and I have trouble sleeping because of it. I'm in a lot of pain, and that's difficult. But to an extent, I get used to it.
Right.
You know that 1 to 10 pain scale they have at hospitals?
Yes.
I am always at the least at like a 6. And that's at my best. And
that's,
I do everything I can to, you know, put on a good face and not let it, you know, show how much pain I'm in. And so because of that...
Well, yeah, I mean, you're very successful at it. Yeah, you're very successful at it. Because like I said, I cannot... I was thinking back before I said you're one of the most you know, calm and even-keeled and positive people that I know. I was trying to think back, and I really could not remember a time when I saw you truly, like, pissed off or frustrated. You know, you and I have talked about other things that have happened in your life, and you've seemed kind of sad about it or resolved about it, but never frustrated or angry or, you know, any of the things that I feel like any, you know, rational person would feel when you're in that much pain, right? Because, I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've seen people that when they're just in pain, they're just not nice people, right? You know, and kind of, oh, you know, I'm, you know, I know you're in pain, I'm sorry, you know, that kind of thing. And I can't, like, yeah, again, it was one of those things where I was just like, you'd never know that the guy was in pain. He walks around with a cane, but he's just rocking it and not complaining ever. So, yeah, I just, it's a modern miracle of both medicine and your resolve.
Yeah, and a lot of that, I don't know if I want to say attribute to or give thanks to the Buddhist path that I follow and how much I have learned from that. I actually turned, like, as things were really getting worse for me, that's actually when I turned to Buddhism, because I felt I needed help kind of finding inner peace and finding some level of sanctuary in myself, more so than even outwardly. And so that's what I turn to, and I think that is what has helped me a lot. But also, like, aside, one of the things about MS is that it's considered an invisible illness. Aside from those that have particular things, like I walk with a cane, and then there are some that have it so bad they've been paralyzed and actually do need a wheelchair still. For the most part, you don't look at somebody and just see that they have MS. There's not really any super outward signs of it. And so it's an invisible illness, and there are many that just, you know, don't understand chronic illness or disability, especially if it's an invisible illness. Like, when you can look at someone and see, oh, they're, you know, a paraplegic, that's a disability. I can just look right at it and spot it and understand it.
Yeah.
Whereas if I wasn't using my cane, I look healthy and normal, and no one would really think otherwise.
Yeah, I actually had a professor in college that had MS, and she would be fine one day, and then, you know, I'd come back to class a week later, and she was in a wheelchair. And, you know, there were a lot of people that didn't know she had MS, and so when they saw that, you know, it was very much like a, oh, my God, what happened, right? Because they had no idea that she had been diagnosed with MS several years before. So that's actually a very interesting, you know, kind of part of that to look at, is that, you know, you never know what's going on with somebody just under the surface. And, you know, it is kind of it's invisible in that you're right. If you don't have a cane, how nobody would know, right? Not that it's anyone's business, but I mean, we should all treat each other a little better regardless of, you know, what the case may be. But still, I think that, but that's got to be kind of tough.
Yeah, but I mean, just like, you know, there are many people that you might look at and never know if they had transitioned or had gender reassignment surgery or anything along those lines. You never know what kind of chronic, progressive, incurable disease they might have.
Right.
And so I've kind of learned to accept both things. Like, I just don't assume things about people as much as I may have before, whether it be about gender or sexuality or how able-bodied someone might be.
Yeah. So did your diagnosis affect anything about, you know, we talked about how it changed the way you viewed your life and the way you viewed the world, and your how it may or may not have affected your abilities and your transition. Did it at all affect the way that your family, this is kind of a complex question, but did your diagnosis at all affect the way your family or any of your friends saw or accepted your gay and trans identities? Like, were there people that were kind of on the fence about accepting the fact that you were gay or that you were trans or and that you were trans that when you were diagnosed kind of went, this is stupid, right? Life is short. What difference does it make? Like, did you have any of that where your diagnosis or your disease affected that kind of vision or that acceptance of you and your other identities?
I really wish that I could say it did, because as you and I have talked about personally, the only person in my life that doesn't accept those parts of me is my dad. And I really would have hoped that with something like this, he would have been able to, you know, essentially grow up and see, like you said, you know, life is short. There's more important things to worry about than, you know, whether or not you think it's right or reasonable or legitimate or whatever word he wants to use regarding his religion and how it sees, you know, those that are gay or trans. He didn't change at all. Like, he did show a lot of support for me, like, about having MS, and he, like, for a little while I talked to him more, if only to tell him what was going on, and he would, you know, ask me how I'm doing. But as it became more obvious that he still was just never going to come around and just actually told me that,
right,
because it would violate his religion, he will never see me as male, never use my name, never use male pronouns, I finally reached a point where I had to step back and say, I have gone through way too much. I have been through too much, experienced too much to get where I am today to put up with that, even if it's from my dad.
Right.
And so I've stopped speaking to him and have since heard from my mom that he is telling people that his daughter has MS and he has taken a lot of time off to go out of state and take care of her.
When was the last time you saw him?
Last June.
So is he just taking a really long vacation in your name or in your old name?
Yeah, like, I don't know. I don't know how. I have no idea how no one has called him out to be like, what are you talking about? You've never been gone that long. Like, are you serious? Like, what? And yeah, the only time I've seen him since, I went down there. Like, I went to Florida to see him. And that was the last time I've seen him. But he's apparently just compulsively lying and telling people about, you know, how, you know, unfortunate his daughter with MS is and how he's taking care of her. And so, yeah, that's mostly my experience with that.
That's entertaining.
Yeah, right? It's truly awful. I have no idea. But,
well,
because aside from that, like, at work, you know, who knows if in due time that'll change. No one knows that I'm trans. Like, as far as anyone at work is concerned, I'm just a, you know, cis male with a disability. And for the most part, that's what they see,
right,
is my disability. Because, like, I have to, like, at the register, like, I sit on a stool.
Right.
Because I can't stand for too long because of the pain. And I can't do all of the same jobs that my coworkers can do and are supposed to do because of my limitations. And so really that's what they see. They don't see anything peculiar about my gender. They just see the fact that I'm a guy that walks with a cane, and they know that I have MS, and most of them don't know anything about what MS is.
Well, they're obviously not alone in that. So, talk about, speaking of work and ways of supporting yourself, let's talk for a second about your Etsy store, MS Won't Stop Me. Can you tell our listeners about kind of where you came up with this idea, what it is, how to find it, all that kind of stuff?
Back when I was in, more of a bad state physically, when I thought that I wouldn't be able to possibly go out and, you know, get a job or hold a job by any means.
Right.
I've always been rather artistic. I draw, do origami, I do all sorts of things, and I knew how to make jewelry. And I wondered what I could do to at least make a couple bucks here and there to help with things that were very expensive, you know, just at home.
Right.
While I was still, you know, forced to be at home most of the time. And so I started making jewelry, little beaded bracelets and necklaces, and decided to open an Etsy store. And so, of course, when it came to naming it, the one thing that came to mind was the fact that MS won't stop me. And so my Etsy store is MS Won't Stop Me. And I sell the jewelry that I make. And for a long time, it was just, you know, rather, you know, normal feminine jewelry. But I have since started making things that are, you know, a reference to or just a direct representation of, like, the trans pride flag colors, things like that, you know, things meant for the LGBT community, things that they might understand more than, you know, cis people from a heteronormative society that may not know,
right,
wouldn't think about it.
Yeah.
Not everyone knows that the blue, pink, white, you know, pattern is the transgender pride flag.
Right.
And so I started making jewelry, you know, with those colors. And ever since, the trans pride bracelet that I make is my most popular selling item.
Yeah, you sold out of it at Trans Pride this past summer. People were really loving it. That and the keychain, I think that a lot of people really dug that. And so for those of you that are listening, if you guys were at DC Trans Pride and you happened to stop by the DCATS booth and buy one of those bracelets, the voice you've been listening to all night is the maker of that jewelry. And I noticed online that you have a Facebook page that if our listeners just Google MS Won't Stop Me, you do get a Google return of your Facebook page, which has more information and a direct link to your Etsy store. That's still active, correct?
Yes. Yes, it
cool.
is.
Cool. So, I mean, I got to tell you, this is something that that I think is amazing that you kind of just said, okay, this is what I've got to do to take care of me, and I'm going to do it. And it's also very big in the spirit of the fact that you're like, I won't stop, and this is my life, and I'm going to take the bull by the horns, so to speak. And so I think that another thing that I want to briefly talk about in the last couple of minutes that we've got is I want to say thank you to you, not only for joining us tonight and being a guest, but also that one of the things that we said at the very beginning of the show was that you were now the DCATS facilitator. And for those listeners that know that I have been involved with DCATS for the last several years as a facilitator, may have wondered what's going on with that. I want to thank you for taking over DCATS facilitator. For those listeners that don't know, this is my last broadcast as a Washington, D.C. resident. As of Tuesday afternoon, my wife and I will both be moving to Georgia. In fact, for those of you that listen to other Back to Us shows, we will just be a hop, skip, and a jump from Miss Anise, aka Doc. And so we'll continue the show and we'll continue to broadcast that. But that's my little transition of my own as I'm moving from a place with 473,000 people and a good chunk of trans folks to a small town in Georgia with 4,100 people and no trans people that I've met thus far. Have met some gay folks, but no trans folks that I've met thus far in this small town. And one of the things that I kind of had to shift and give up was DCATS. But I know that it's in amazing hands, Nicholas, and so I want to thank you for taking over that group. And I definitely obviously want to thank you for joining us here tonight. But I want to thank you for taking over that group, because it is something that's meant a lot to me and to the other people that have run it for the several years past, and the webmasters and everybody that's still involved. So, yeah, I mean, are you looking forward to that role?
I am. I'm actually really looking forward to it. Being quite honest, when I first decided, like when I was first deciding that I wanted to do it, one of the symptoms, a very common symptom of MS is depression. And
right.
I was actually, like, I've actually battled depression for most of my life, but it was particularly bad. And I was admittedly in a period of my life where I was having suicidal ideations. And I was looking for any sort of bargaining chip that I could grab that would tether me to this life and give me a reason to not want to do something like that.
Yeah.
And so on one hand, like, I was sort of using the opportunity to give myself a responsibility big enough
right.
that I wouldn't feel that I could do such a thing, because now there are people that depend on me for something important. And since then, since I have had treatment and come out of that dark hole, I've, you know, really thought more about it and about how I genuinely want to be part of this and want to be part of something like this. To, you know, there was so long that my thought was reach the point where, you know, nobody sees me as anything but cis and just go stealth and that be that, and I would be done. And
yeah.
But now I see that, you know, there's so much more that, you know, not only that I can offer, but that other people can offer as well. And I want to help them get the chance to do that.
That's awesome. And I think that's, I couldn't have said it better myself. And so again, you know, I want to thank you for being on the show tonight. I swear I could talk to you about this all night. We are unfortunately pretty much out of time, but I want to thank you for joining us tonight. I want to thank you just personally for taking over DCATS. For those of you listening, MS won't stop me. Google it, find it. It's a great store. DCATS, they have meetings second Sunday of every month in Washington, D.C. at Whitman Walker Clinic. You can find that group on Facebook as well. I also, in addition to thanking Nicholas, I want to thank our sponsors, Audible.com, and giving our listeners the chance to download a book for free. And the book that I have for you this month to download as a recommendation is The Book Thief. You've heard of the movie that just recently came out? Read the book. I read it a couple of years ago. It is amazing. Such a great story, The Book Thief. Nicholas, thank you so much. We have to roll, but thank you for being here again and sharing your story with everybody.
Yes, and thank you.
Absolutely. Until next month, thank you so much. Back to us and Strong Stance listeners. Have a great night.
You have been listening to a recording provided by Voice Republic at http://voicerepublic.com.